My name is Jim Hilgendorf. Thank you very much for inviting me here today to speak. This one gentleman was mentioning a book about marriage, and it just reminded me, I was talking at one of the UU places down in Santa Rosa, and I had it all prepared, and a gentleman came up with this, my wife was there, and he found out we were married 44 years. And he came up to me and he said he wondered if I could change the program and tell how you stay married for 44 years. Anyway, I'm really honored to be here. I'm very familiar with the UU, and I have nothing but respect for your great organization. And I'm very moved by your spirit here today, too. Just a little background. My wife, Elizabeth, and I have been practicing Buddhism with the Soka Gakkai International for 44 years now. And Soka Gakkai is now the largest Buddhist organization in the world. It's in 192 countries, roughly 12 million members. And it's a philosophy and a practice that's based upon the Lotus Sutra, recognizing the sanctity of all life and the unlimited potential that every human being inherently possesses for limitless growth and happiness. The current president of the Soka Gakkai is a man named Daisaku Ikeda. He's a prolific writer, educator, and founder of a number of cultural and educational peace research institutes around the world. One thing, he was never able to go to college, but growing up in war-torn, ravaged Japan, he couldn't go to college, but he's received at this date over 360 honorary doctorates and degrees from universities all over the world. So that's a record unsurpassed. I was told by Paul that he mentioned one of your members who had passed away recently, and he asked me maybe to talk a little bit about the Buddhist concept of perspective on life and death. And because that's kind of the subject of some of my books. Rather than talk too much about Buddhism today, I'd like to bring in some topics and read several pieces that from different sources that have made a great impact on me, and put them together in such a way that maybe kind of give you a perspective on your own life. There's no doubt that with the rise of science over the past 400 years, the worldview of our major religions have been really shaken to the core. We live in an incredibly vast universe. You know, we got like 200 billion stars in our galaxy, and there are hundreds of billions of galaxies out there just reaching out into inconceivable space and time. And see, this is a universe that our ancestors never even imagined whatsoever. And what are we doing here all alone, you know, on this inconceivably minute little speck here of stardust in this universe? Billions of people still adhere to the fundamentals of Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and their view of life and death. But increasingly, many others have really abandoned religions altogether. Atheists, humanists, secular believers. Roughly 25% of the population now in the United States is unaffiliated with any mainline religion, and their ranks are growing, especially among the youth. They accept the revelations of reason and science, discarding any theism or outside power or God, and while attempting to really live a moral life with this single, limited earthly existence. Why religion at all, they ask. But, you know, increasingly, interestingly, science itself has really shattered this kind of classical concept of science and this view of the universe that like sitting out there somewhere, running on its own laws and disconnected to our personal lives. There's really another universe out there, many universes, full of surprises, really unbelievable. And this is, part of this is the quantum world, which is uncovered at the beginning of the 20th century. This is a world of electrons, atoms, quarks, bosons, strings, dark matter. This world exists and underlies and comprises everything we see. And it underlies everything we ourselves also, body and mind, because we're bound by these same immutable laws. This is a world that behaves with its own laws, one that seems to turn the usual concepts of laws upside down. Nothing can be quite pinpointed here. We're dealing with a world of uncertainty, with electrons, for instance, in different sides of the universe, that seem to be being able to communicate with each other instantaneously, faster than the speed of light. One of the great physicists of the early 1900s, when quantum physics was being born, his name was John Wheeler, commented, quote, he said, "Nothing is more important about the quantum principle than this, that it destroys the concept of the world as sitting out there." To describe what's happened, one has to cross out the old word observer and put in its place the new word participator. In some strange sense, the universe is a participatory universe. In other words, our own lives and the lives of others and the universe around are truly interconnected in ways that we can hardly even imagine. This is what science is telling us now. Who are we really? So I'd like to, this is a question I'd like to just explore just a little bit. I'd like to talk about holograms. Holograms are those three-dimensional light images that are illuminated by lasers. You may remember the little robot in the film Star Wars R2-D2. R2-D2 was really carried within its memory bank a picture of Princess Leia was projected out to try to get help. This is a hologram. There's a curious property about holograms. If you take a hologram and say, picture of an apple, and you cut it in half, the light image, each half still shows a picture of the whole apple still there. No matter how many times you slice up the hologram, the picture of the entire whole apple is still there. No matter how small, always the part always contains the whole. While each fragment of the hologram contains the whole image, each individual fragment mirrors the whole in just a slightly different way. It's like a different angle, like an individualized personality. Holograms, I really feel, reflect the truth about our lives. In some amazing way, each of us contains the entire universe. Our life is separate, and yet it's the whole. Can you imagine 7 billion separate lives on this planet, and yet the reality being that each one of us contains the universe? That we have the power, innate and undiscovered within us each moment, to influence the creation of everything around us, including the universe as a whole. In the Power of Myth, this is the great dialogue with Bill Moyers. Joseph Campbell, the great writer and mythologist, stated, quote, "There's a definition of God which has been repeated by many philosophers. God is an intelligible sphere whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. And the center is right where you're sitting. And the other one is right where I'm sitting. And each of us is a manifestation of that mystery." End quote. In the 13th century, Nietzsche, whose life and writings along with the Lotus Sutra are the foundation of the Soka Gakkai, wrote, quote, "Ultimately, all phenomena are contained within one's life, down to the last particle of dust. The 9 mountains and the 8 seas are encompassed in one's body, and the sun, moon, and myriad stars are found in one's life. We, however, are like a blind person who is incapable of seeing the images reflected in the mirror." End quote. You know, many of you, I think, may be familiar with the work of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. I bring this up just to kind of lead into something else. But you know, Kubler-Ross was a great researcher on death and dying, a professor at psychiatry at the University of Chicago. Over the years, she dealt with thousands terminally ill patients, and some of these patients would apparently die and then revive and then come back to tell of their near-death experiences. She wrote, after they leave, they go toward a light, a tunnel, over a bridge or river. After they pass over, then comes what a Christian would call hell. There's no God who condemns you, but you're forced to review your own life. It's like watching a television screen, and your whole life is passed in front of you. You see everything you've done and thought. So it's not a God who condemns you, but you condemn yourself. After encountering many of these similar experiences, all ages, all different cultures, she wrote, quote, up until then I had absolutely no belief in an afterlife, but the data convinced me that these were no coincidences or hallucinations. These stories talk of meeting a light. In connection with this, I'd like to read passages from the last part of Leo Tolstoy's great novella, The Death of Ivan Ilyich. This story follows an official in the Russian government, Ivan Ilyich, who leads a rather normal life, family, career, struggles of everyday life, occupying himself until suddenly in his mid-40s, he comes down with a strange and progressively fatal disease. At first, he's only a little worried. Then, as the pain increases, he's forced to confront the possibility of his death. The reality of his own approaching death becomes unbearable and overwhelming. He's forced to search for answers, to struggle with his own mortality, to reevaluate all he's been or done. And it's only during the last few moments of his life on his deathbed that he finds some answers. And in those moments, his life is utterly transformed. Tolstoy writes, quote, for three straight days, during which time did not exist for him, he struggled in that black sack into which he was being thrust by an unseen, irresistible force. He struggled as a man condemned to death fights in the hands of an executioner, knowing he cannot save himself. In every moment, he felt that despite all his struggles, he was drawing nearer and nearer to what terrified him. He felt he was in agony because he was being thrust into that black hole, but at the same time, was not really able to get right into it. What prevented him from getting into it was his belief that his life had been good. This very justification of his life held him fast and prevented him from advancing and caused him more agony than anything else. Suddenly, some force struck him in the chest and side, making it still harder to breathe. He fell through the hole, and there at the bottom was a light. This took place at the end of the third day, an hour before his death. Just then, his schoolboy's son had crept into the room and gone up to his father's bedside. The dying man was still screaming desperately, waving his arms. His hand fell on the child's head. The boy seized it, pressed it to his lips, and began to cry. At that very moment, Ivan Ilyich fell through the hole and caught sight of the light. And it was revealed to him that his life had not been what it ought to have been, but that it was still possible to put it right. But what's the right thing, he asked himself, and grew still listening. Just then he felt someone kissing his hand. He opened his eyes and looked at his son. He felt sorry for him. His wife came up to him. When he looked at her, she was gazing at him with open mouth, with unwiped tears on her nose and cheeks, and a look of despair on her face. He felt sorry for her. And suddenly, it became clear to him that what had been oppressing him and would not go away was now dropping away on one side, two sides, 10 sides, on all sides. He felt sorry for them. He wanted to do something for them, to release them himself from this suffering. How good and how simple, he thought. And the pain, he asked himself, where is it gone? Where are you, pain? He began to look for it. Yes, here it is. Well, what of it? Let it be. And death? He searched for his accustomed fear of death and did not find it. Where is it? What death? There was no fear because there was no death. Instead of death, there was light. So that's it, he exclaimed. What joy. All this happened in a single moment, and the meaning of that moment did not change thereafter. For those present, his agony continued another 2 hours. Something rattled in his throat. His emaciated body twitched, and the gasping and rattle became less frequent. It's all over, said someone near. He heard the words and repeated them in his soul. Death is over, he said. It's no more. He drew in a breath, stopped in the middle of it, stretched out, and died. End quote. Beautiful. With the meaning of this light, a new dimension unfolds within the mind and soul of Ivan Ilyich, one filled with deep compassion and a sense of the eternity of life. This moving, fictionalized account is very similar to actual experiences recounted by those who have gone through near-death experiences and encounter with delight a sense of extraordinary compassion emanating from it. What is this light? Some feel it's a religious figure like Christ or Buddha, but in his book, Life at Death, A Scientific Investigation of the Near-Death Experience, Dr. Kenneth Ring, who's another great researcher into death and dying, examined in detail the stories of many people who had near-death experiences and was able to show that religion is no more a factor in the near-death experience than race or age. He also stated the conclusions his investigations had led him to, the objective detachment from the body, the sense of a different dimension of space and time, the travel down a dark space or tunnel, were indications of Dr. Ring of a dramatic shift in consciousness. But his most astonishing conclusion, I think, follows. He writes, the next phenomenon that manifests itself is, of course, the brilliant golden light, which is sometimes seen at the end of the tunnel and other times appears independent of the tunnel experience. I submit that this presence or voice is actually oneself. It's not merely a projection of one's personality, however, but one's total self, or in what some traditions is called the higher self. In this view, the individual personality is but a split-off fragment total self, of which it is reunited at the point of death. During ordinary life, the individual personality functions in a seemingly autonomous way, as though it were a separate unity. In fact, however, it is invisibly tied to the larger self structure of which it's a part. What has this to do with the light, he writes? The answer is, so I would say, that the higher self is so awesome, so overwhelming, so loving and unconditionally accepting, like an all-forgiving mother, and so foreign to one's individualized consciousness that one perceives it as separate from oneself, as unmistakably other. It manifests itself as a brilliant golden light, but it's actually oneself in a higher form that one is seeing. It's though the individual being thoroughly identified with his limited personality asks, what's that beautiful light over there? Never conceiving for a moment that anything so magnificent could possibly be himself or herself and complete, and we need to add here divine manifestation. The light one sees then is one's own. And he writes also, the higher self furthermore has total knowledge of the individual personality, both past and future. That's why when it is experienced as a voice, it seems to be an all-knowing one. That's why it can initiate a life review and in addition provide a preview of an individual's life events. At this level, information is stored holographically, it's a hologram again, and experienced holographically, simultaneously, or nearly so. In the Buddhism of the Soka Gakkai, which is based upon this teaching of the Lotus Sutra, this higher self is called Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, or the Buddha nature, the essence of our own life and everything else in the universe, whatever you name it. This Deva's common core identity is what we need to awaken to if we're going to overcome the divisions and wars we've experienced repeatedly since time immemorial and move on to a new and really different dimension of living and being together here on this planet. Amid all the division and chaos we see around us in the world today, we are actually in the throes of creating a new civilization, a new life based upon a common humanity, the sanctity of all life. Each of you in this room is a catalyst that will usher in this new world. You're the forerunners. You may look upon yourself as insignificant when compared to the vast world and universe around you, but just as a tiny slice of a hologram reflects changes in the whole, so do the workings of your heart and mind impact and alter the fabric of the cosmos itself. This new civilization can only be created through the transformation of individual human beings. It will not be created through a change in social or political or military or economic systems and structures. It's an inner transformation, a raising of consciousness and life state. It is above all an expansion of the heart.